A mouse took a stroll through the deep, dark wood. A fox saw the mouse, and the mouse looked good. "Where are you going to, little brown mouse? Come and have lunch in my underground house."
Julia Donaldson's classic children's tale about the Gruffalo is just one of six-year-old Maya's favourite stories, and the bedtime readings with her mum, Sian, one of her favourite times.
I love this book.
So what is a Gruffalo?
He has prickles on his back.
He does have prickles on his back.
Look on the page.
And just tell me a bit more about the stories you like.
The hunt. I like the girls don't bark one.
What's that? Girls don't bark?
Girls don't fart.
Oh.
There is actually a book out there that is published, Peter, that is called that. Exactly what you think you've heard.
Well, extraordinary.
Pepper's Party House.
Room on the Broom?
No.
Is that one not your favourite anymore?
Nope.
What's wrong with Room on the Broom, Maya?
That is not good anymore.
Oh, it's not good anymore.
It's not good. That's a Halloween.
Oh, it's only good for Halloween, Peter.
Well, if the Royal Society for Blind Children gets its way, Sian could in future be reading The Gruffalo, some of Maya's list of favourites, and other stories to many visually impaired youngsters. The Society is concerned about what it calls a chronic lack of audio books available to visually impaired children, and it's launching a campaign it calls Bedtime Donations, which would build up a free library of audio books via an app. It'll feature recordings of parents reading to their own children and a handful of celebrity personalities volunteering to record classic children's stories.
I'm Alison Steadman. I'm recording Sleeping Beauty. "What are you doing?" asked the princess. "I'm spinning, my dear," the old woman replied. "Oh, that looks fun. Let me try," the princess said. She took the spindle in her hand and almost immediately pricked her finger. She fell to the floor, unconscious.
Hello, I'm John Richardson. I am reading The Tale of Mr. Jeremy Fisher by Beatrix Potter. Mr. Jeremy shoved the boat out again a little way and dropped in the bait. There was a bite almost directly. The float gave a tremendous bobbit. A minnow! A minnow! I have him by the nose!
John Richardson and before that, Alison Steadman. Well, Sian Hughes has been telling me why she thinks this campaign is so important and demonstrating how it'll work.
So if I open my phone and go to apps and then I select the Bedtime Donations app. Once the app is loaded, you come to an initial page where you've got two choices. You can listen to a story or you can donate a story. So for this example, I'm going to donate a story. So if I click donate a story, and then it opens a page now, which is full of all the different genres of different books that you can read, from classics, poems, adventure, princesses, and many, many more. So for this example, I'm going to click adventure. So there's one here called All the Stars in the Night Sky. It then brings me up an instructions page with the book in the background. So on the instructions page, it's telling me that if I press the record button at the bottom, it will record me. And if at any point I want to pause, I can just press it again and pause. I can go and make myself a cup of tea, go and sort the kids' bath time, and then I can return to that recording again later and finish it off. Once I've recorded that story, I can then press to publish it. This story will then go off to the AI creators at RSBC and they will clear any of the background noise out of my recording and then it will be published into the app.
And how difficult is it for you to read a story to Maya every night?
Every night it's quite difficult. You know, I've got three children to juggle between, but we do try and make time to read bedtime stories every night that I am here. But I work long hours as a nurse, so two long day shifts a week I work. So there's two nights of every week where I can't be at home reading bedtime stories because I don't get in until way past Maya's bedtime.
What would you say is the significance of the bedtime story and, in a way, the significance of it being you that reads it, even if you're not there.
Yeah, I think it's really important, you know, that parents can read with their children, have those close connections, and that we've got a good routine going, because children with visual impairments tend to respond better to routine, because obviously they know what's coming next then, and it winds them down, relaxes them, ready for bedtime.
Maya, would you like to have your mum reading you a story, even if she couldn't get home from working in the hospital?
Yes. I do. I love bedtime stories.
So are you looking forward to this system that there's going to be where your mum can read to you even if she's not there?
Yes. So tomorrow night...
Well, tonight we're going to try it, aren't we?
Yeah. Or you can just try to read me a book from downstairs.
Well, yes, I could read you a book from downstairs.
Sian and Maya. Well, I'm joined now by Julie Davis, CEO of the Royal Society for Blind Children. Julie, before we get on to the scheme itself, just explain a little bit about the society and where it fits into the provision of services for blind children.
The society works with children and families from birth to age 25 years. And that might be at the point of diagnosis, it might be a point of transition, and you are perhaps introduced to this whole world of acronyms and change, and you're unsure of what to do next. So we supply support around emotional well-being, we supply activities, residential trips. We have a whole programme of support that parents and children and young people feed back to us that are priorities for them to allow them to be as included in society as possible.
You say there's a shortage of books for blind children, and I'd be the last person to say we didn't need as many books as possible. But to be fair, there are other services around. You know, there is the RNIB's Talking Book Library, which reckons it's got over 7,000 books in their children's collection. There's Calibre, which is another service which is free to children. What will you be offering that they aren't?
So the thing that was magical about this, really, Peter, was the fact that for very young children, they would have a familiar voice. And this would be a parent or an older sibling or a grandparent, somebody that could connect with them and they could recognise. So this was about a level playing field, but also about increasing choice and making it personalised. My daughter is blind, and I can remember as a child, and as she was growing up, she would select, you know, she said, I'm not that keen on that person that's telling that story. It's not the story, it's the voice. So I think this is really critical in the Bedtime Donations app, is that personalisation.
Do you think there are barriers to there not being enough children's audiobooks in particular?
I think there are always barriers where you've not got full access and full choice. And I understand the economics. It's much more expensive to produce audiobooks, and that you might not automatically have the full range and full choice of what you might be able to buy in print. And I accept that to a degree, but we've got to be as inclusive as we can, and we've got to find solutions. And for Royal Society for Blind Children, we thought this was a really good solution to what quite a comprehensive issue.
Now, we've heard Sian describing very clearly how the recording process works. The success of the scheme surely is going to rely on parents having the time, the energy, the commitment, you know, to provide readings of books. Isn't that expecting quite a lot of them? You know, it might be the sort of idea which people start with enormous enthusiasm, but then find it quite hard to sustain.
I hope they won't, because they're still going to be reading stories to their children. So I would hope that they would just press record as they're doing it and feel it's a natural part of their day. I mean, in the first 2 hours, we have 500 downloads and 700 recordings of new stories.
Really?
That's now increased to 2,500 downloads. And we've had 1,300 people volunteering and recording a book. If anything, our biggest issue, Peter, is we haven't got enough stories. We're desperate for more stories to be made available so that we can record them and that, you know, we're not infringing on any copyright. Or we're looking for original works that can be brought forward. But I think parents and families and extended family will always find the time for something that is so precious.
So how big do you think the potential of this idea is?
Well, as a free service, we would hope this would run into thousands, if not more. It could go into different languages. You know, we've already had different accents coming through, which is really good for further inclusion with our children. So they're recognising the different accents that we have across England and Wales. But for us, the greater vision and that greater goal is the largest free bedtime books provision for children and young people. We would just love this to, you know, go beyond our wildest dream.
Well, we shall see. Just very quickly, how can people take part in that case? What do they have to do?
If you go into Google Play or your app store and look up for bedtime donations, it should be near the top. Download the app and then follow the instructions for listening mode or donate mode.
Julie Davis, CEO of the Royal Society for Blind Children. Thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And there's another potentially positive piece of help being offered that we wanted to cover today. All too often on this programme, we hear from people who feel that they haven't been properly supported at the time of their diagnosis of their eye condition. The clinical treatment might be fine, but knowing what to do next, how to cope emotionally, maybe even the issue of what financial help they're entitled to, can seem like a mountain to climb with no one to tell you how to climb it. But one group of London hospitals trying to do something about this are part of the Imperial College NHS Trust, which oversees Charing Cross, Queen Charlotte and Chelsea, Hammersmith, St Mary's and Western Eye Hospital. Charlie Evans is assistant psychologist at St Mary's Hospital, who's involved in putting together the case for incorporating better psychological help into the clinical programme that people receive. Charlie, that's the outline. Tell me more about what you've got in mind.
What we've recognised in current provision is that there are no dedicated psychological care pathways for ophthalmology conditions within the NHS. And whilst that's not to say people can't access other services, such as talking therapies, I think we recognise that there's dynamic need, specifically within sight loss and visual impairment, that might not be being met by these services. And also that these are quite specific. There's a lot of specific emotional considerations and considerations around adaptation that we believe in talks with clinicians and third-party charities such as RNIB might not be currently being met within NHS provisions. So we're looking to maybe do something about that.
Is it maybe ophthalmologists who you're partly aiming this at who feel that, you know, their job is to look at the eye but don't necessarily feel it's part of their job to see what happens behind that?
Certainly. And in discussions that we've had with ophthalmologists already, they have highlighted that whilst they're incredibly proficient at what they do and dealing with the physical side of people's health, they feel they may not have the knowledge and skills sufficient to deal with some of the emotional ramifications that certainly diagnosis and adaptation to eye conditions can have.
But that's the point, that you want people listening to this programme to get in touch and tell you what happened to them.
Yeah, ideally we'd love to hear both the strengths of current provision, but also any shortfalls or limitations or potentially service provisions that people would have wished they had or had been able to access around the time of diagnosis or later dynamically along the sort of sight loss and visual impairment care pathways. Really, we don't want to reinvent the wheel in terms of services that are already being provided. But we also recognise that anything new that we do offer should actually fit the needs of patients. And the actual gaps in provision, which is why we're so keen to hear from people and to integrate that into our service provision case.
Right. Well, we will tell people how to do that at the end of this. But of course, giving extra support to people at this time is the whole point of ECLOs, their eye care liaison officers. And that's why the RNIB has been campaigning so hard to have an ECLO in every hospital and clinic where eye care is offered. So we're joined by Diva Shah, who is an ECLO, at Western Eye Hospital. That's part of the trust, and she is also part of the RNIB's ECLO scheme. Diva, does this mean that having one ECLO in a hospital isn't enough?
No, definitely not. We are trying across England to get more ECLOs, but with expanding health needs, large populations, we do recognise that a ECLO is not going to be enough, and particularly for the project that we're looking at, because whilst ECLOs do provide that emotional and practical support at the point of diagnosis, and sometimes not necessarily at the point of diagnosis, a significant number of our patients are not getting the psychological help that they need. So it's nice to have an ECLO, but we don't work in isolation. We work best when we've got other support services in place alongside.
So from your experience, what would you say are the areas which are being neglected at the moment, you know, when it comes to visually impaired people's psychological care?
Certainly long-term counselling services, the type that Charlie is working on in our hospital, but even including things like getting out and about. We do know that for patients to maximise their independence and quality of life, there is elements where they might need a sensory impairment team to get involved. And across London, I know we don't have enough provision for that. So that's another big campaign. And it's about trying to tackle this from as many different sides as we can to maximise that quality of life and independence. The other thing that we do recognise with our patients is that, you know, they're almost 10 times more likely to have a fall. And that question often isn't asked to patients with a vision impairment, whether certified or not, is have you had a fall? So it's then putting the support services, I guess, in place to support those patients, even in their own home and when they're out and about.
How short are we of ECLOs? I mean, you are working. Are there still quite a lot of hospitals and departments that don't have them?
Yes, there are quite a lot. I couldn't give you an exact number. But when the ECLO role started 30 years ago, you know, we were talking about one or two ECLOs, and now we're talking about 162 across the UK, which is quite significant. Mm-hmm. It's also worth adding that the Royal College of Ophthalmologists have also, in their new training scheme for junior doctors, have added that they should be shadowing an ECLO at least once or twice. And you see the benefits of that, because then they go on to other hospitals where they don't have an ECLO, and the first thing they ask is, where is the ECLO? So it's quite a significant shift in the environment we're working with from 30 years ago to now, which is great. It is phenomenal, but yes, there's still a long way to go.
So Charlie, just to come back to you finally, you want to hear from patients, as we've said. How easy are you making it for people to get in touch with you if you want visually impaired people to do this?
Well, hopefully we've made it as easy as possible. So we currently have an email address set up that people can write into. And we also have a voicemail service that people can phone into and leave a few of their details. And then we can contact them at a later date for a bit more of an in-depth discussion. So the email address that we've set up is imperial.intouch@nhs.net. And our phone line is 0200-3311-3322.
Most important for those people who don't want to go online. Charlie Evans, Diva Shah, thank you. Thank you both very much. And that telephone number again, 0200-3311-3322. That's it for today. But as always, we want to hear from you. You can email in touch at bbc.co.uk, or you can leave voice messages on 0161 8.